Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a grant from the Scarman Trust. We're sometimes on Bristol Community FM 93.2 Tuesdays at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week's Frances Leader. She runs something called Frack News. She's a long-time campaigner, but she's now finds it difficult to get out, so she runs the magazine All About Fracking from her home in Dorset. Also, John Hagedorn runs a podcast called 1001 Heroes at 1001heroespodcast.com. He talks to me about A Bridge Too Far, or was it Too Far from the Bridge, the Battle of Arnhem, in Holland in September 1944. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk, and we're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show. Okay, so could you introduce yourself? Tell us where you are.
Hi, Tony. It's Frances Leader, and I'm in Corf Mullen in Dorset.
Tell us about fracking, because I know you take quite a... You've been going as an activist for decades, and I think fracking is just the latest thing you've gotten involved in. Just remind us why you think fracking is such an important thing to the environment generally.
I think fossil fuels is the filthiest in many respects, not just in terms of the environment, but in terms of the corruption that it leads to in the world. So I think fossil fuels as a whole is the thing that I object to. And their recent addition of this latest technological development to frack has created so much devastation and misery in the lives of people who live in the oil fields and gas fields of North America and Australia. And the way that they are dealing with that misery is to silence it, buy it off, or quell any opposition whatsoever with some pretty draconian activities.
Okay, so what's been happening? What's been happening here in Britain then?
In 2011, a company called Quadrilla drilled a well up in the Fylde in Lancashire. The Fylde is a region just to the north of Blackpool. What they have done is, in 2011, Quadrilla drilled there, and the well was damaged, and they continued to pump frack fluid into the well and caused an earthquake. In 2012, the government decided to bring out a moratorium so that fracking was held until investigations were undertaken. In the meantime, the returning frack fluids and solids were sent to a waste disposal place in Manchester, and they were flushed into the Manchester Ship Canal and from there into the Irish Sea. The next thing that happened was in 2013, the same company, Quadrilla, set up another Ponzi scheme shell small company called Quadrilla Balcom, and started to drill for oil or gas there. The local people had this literally foisted upon them without very much understanding or knowledge of what was going on. There was certainly no public consultation. And they put out an alarm online saying, you know, we've got this industry setting up in our beautiful Sussex village and we don't want it. And activists came from all over the country to see if there was any way that we could support them in their self-defence. Well, that camp at Balcombe started in the July of that year, and it grew to the point where we had We were actually feeding more than 200 people a day on site, and that was supported by the local community and by restaurants and people from miles around who were literally turning up every single day with goods and services, even in some cases providing us with ready-cooked meals to keep us there so that we would put pressure on Quadrilla. And what we did was made it as difficult as we possibly could for them to continue working on that site. Obviously, the police were involved, and they turned up in droves. We had 3 solid months of massive over-policing, and the police were called in from all over the country, and we were literally being used as a training ground for these police officers, and we were being treated as if we were, I would call it, like industrial terrorists, because what we were doing was trying to stop or slow down this industry and at the same time attract as much attention in the media as we possibly could, so that the rest of the country would become aware that this was just going to be the very first attempt by Quadrilla, and that petrol licenses, petroleum extraction licenses, were actually being dished out all over the place, more than 60% of England, not UK, just England, was marked up on a map going to be fracked. Now, when we looked at what was going on in Pennsylvania, the Marcellus Shale oil field and gas field, when you look at that from an aerial view, it just looks horrific. It's pad after pad after pad for miles and miles and miles. A pad is a concrete square, which is the base for the drilling operation. And on that pad is all the equipment and the lorries, and it's just a big concrete square. And each one's got a road leading to it. And if you look at Pennsylvania on Google Maps, it goes for miles and miles, the same in Texas, the same in California, the same in Oklahoma and Ohio and Dakota, north and south. And when you look at these squares from an aerial point of view, it's just a square, a gap, another square, a gap, another square, a gap, with interlocking roads. And the geology for America is nothing like the geology for the UK. They have large chunks of fairly even geology, but we have massive amounts of fractures. And not only that, we also have ancient mining that has gone back centuries, maybe even thousands of years, but nobody knows what's where. So what I'm saying is, if they drill down and they try to frack, The fluid that they're going to be injecting into the shale rock, what they do is they crack the shale rock with an explosion, first of all. And that explosion is usually done by a Halliburton depleted uranium charge. They literally put in the liner for the well. They put it in straight down, and then they go horizontally for a considerable distance. And then they burst through that pipe with a perforation gun. And then after they've removed all of that, they then send in the frack fluid, which is a combination of millions of gallons of water and chemicals and propant sand or silicon, and they pour that down the well under high pressure so that it bursts out through the holes that the perforation gun has made and cracks all the rock around and releases the gas back into the pipe.
Okay, so look, what's obvious. The problem with this? Because at the end of the day, what you're doing is you're drilling down, you're putting some chemicals in, you've got an explosion, and then what you get back is loads of flammable gas, which can then be just put into the normal gas supply.
Well, yes, apart from the fact that shale is well known for being loaded with radon, and radon doesn't burn in the gas supply. It simply turns to a dust, which is highly carcinogenic. But that's just one aspect of the problem of it. The end, you know, you imagine that coming out of your gas tap is not a good idea. That is not the main thing that concerns us. What concerns us is some of the gas will get back into the pipe and go back up to the surface and be caught. Yeah, but not all of it. A lot of it then can escape from the shale into fractures and fissures in the rock, and rise where it couldn't have done when it was locked in the shale.
Amazing. Anyway, look, also, how are we getting on with fracking nowadays? Are the government still trying to encourage it? Are the companies like Quadrilla still managing to exploit it? Or has how successful, I suppose, has the environmental campaign been?
Oh, I think we've been tremendously successful, because we have, since 2013, we have alerted the entire country. We have now somewhere between 400 and 500 groups scattered all over the country who are all interlinked and working together to oppose these pedal licenses, because each pedal license is controlled by a gas or oil drilling company, and they then have to put in planning permission to the councils, and the councils are in a position to be able to say yes or no. Now, what has happened in Lancashire is Quadrilla has attempted to get planning permission through in a number of sites, and Lancashire County Council, after a great deal of campaigning by our campaigners, has been very, very well informed and rejected that planning permission. Unfortunately, Quadrilla decided to appeal to the government, and the government overturned. Sajid Javid, the chap at the Department of Energy, who decided that Lancashire County Council really didn't know what they were doing, and he overturned their decision. Now, this goes in direct face of the democratic declarations of the Conservatives at their last general meeting that they had. They were saying, we're going to engage the local people more and more. They were talking generally about all subjects, but when it comes to fracking, they will overrule the local councils.
Okay, so what's happened? I mean, are they now doing this fracking now?
Yes, they're about to. What they're doing at Preston New Road in Little Plumpton in Lancashire is, at the present moment, they are drilling in preparation for a frack job, but also another site in Yorkshire called Kirby Misperton. That has previously been drilled, was a prepared drilling done a number of years ago, and they have set up two frack there. That's going to be the first fracking job. And we're waiting right now for Greg Clark to give them the final permission to start fracking. We have two camps at both of those sites that I've mentioned, at Preston New Road and at Kirby Misperton, where we've got campaigners actually camped on site trying to defend those two areas, and they are very well supported by local people, which is really which is really encouraging for us who have been campaigning for so many years.
So the fight is going on, isn't it? I mean, one of the things, though, is that a lot of the knowledge and information about fracking has been shared on social media, things like Twitter, Facebook, this kind of thing, because to a large extent the mainstream press hasn't really done its job in warning people about the dangers of having fracking going on in your area, not least of which is earthquakes. Probably more to the point is the poisoning of the water table. But what are your thoughts about the way whole social media is going? Because there does seem to be an attempt to get social media more in line with what, you know, the mainstream press, the CNNs, the BBCs, these people are saying.
I really honestly have a great deal of faith in social media. I actually experience quite a kickback against mainstream media, and virtually everything that is said by any mainstream media outlet is picked apart, torn apart, and disproved over and over again. And I find that very healthy and very encouraging. I get into conversations and I do find that I am able to, because of the access that I have to reports and to studies that have been done in America and Australia and to films, I have been able to enlighten a lot of people about what is going on. And we have so many groups that are really big and really organized, and some of the admins of those groups are very efficient, making sure that the alternative view to what is being said in the mainstream media gets a good hearing. But of course, unfortunately, not everyone is on social media. Not everybody has access to it, especially older people particularly don't indulge in being online at all. They just sit in front of their television and they are absorbing everything they're getting from the mainstream media, which is entirely, oh, isn't fracking going to be a wonderful thing? It has been, and it's always from the financial point of view and completely avoiding the health risks and the dangers of earthquakes and contamination of the aquifers, the essential aquifers for our water supply. All those subjects are completely avoided on mainstream media. And so anyone who is not on social media is unlikely to have even come across the information that says, no, wait a minute, the health aspects far outweigh the wealth aspects.
What about, I mean, some forms of social media and alternative media, I mean, do you think that some of them are controlled or infiltrated or, you know, kind of another arm of the state? Because you would think that, in fact, it seems pretty clear that there is an attempt to get disinformation out there and to infiltrate the alternative media too.
Oh, goodness me. Since I very first started to be an activist when I was a teenager, I have been aware of they're commonly called shills, but back when I was young, we used to call them controlled opposition operatives. And these are people that are employed by the government or by the industry, whichever industry it may be that you're contending with, and they are employed to control the opposition. This is an old communist ruse that was pulled on the Russians, where what the people try to do who are doing this, they don't directly oppose. They steer you so that you do not oppose for the right reasons and in effective ways. So the controlled opposition operatives are quite clever, and we have them in absolutely every single campaign that I have ever been involved in all of these 50 years. There is no such thing as a campaign against the government that does not have controlled operation.
Can you just give us an example of the sort of, you know, I suppose what you're saying is that the campaigns are being misdirected by these people, and an example of where?
Yes, that is what I'm saying. Absolutely. They're not just misdirected, they are disrupted and they are given a bad reputation.
But give us an example. In what way, for example?
Well, there are five different types, actually, Tony. There's the ones that come from the government. Those are usually police undercovers. And their main objective is to identify everyone that is involved and feed that information back to the headquarters, and then to target those individuals to literally find any dirt that they can from the past of that person and then use that to ruin their reputation with other members of the group. They will set one member off against another by saying, this one said this about you, and then saying the same thing to the other person and causing people to have arguments and fall out. They will get drunk or drugged out of their minds and cause us disrepute by misbehaving in such a way that everyone presumes that all of us are like that, just on the behaviour of one person. They'll get themselves arrested doing things that are completely illegal, again, to put us into disrepute. There are endless games that they play and continue to play. And this has been going on for decades. All the time I've ever known anything about activism is we've dealt with people.
Okay,
like
so
this.
You started with the police there. Can you run through the others?
Yeah. The next one on the list is the people that are employed by the industry. In the case of the oil industry, these are usually very, very well trained, very experienced, and have been involved with the oil industry in the past, and are therefore employed by the oil industry to do pretty much the same things that the police undercovers are doing, but also to misdirect us and make sure that we do not find out some of the really important secrets, such as the exact chemical content of drilling muds and frack fluid. That's a heavily guarded secret throughout the world. And to ensure that we do not find out that those things are severely toxic and carcinogenic, particularly to also make sure that we do not form relationships with people that work in the oil and gas industry, so that we do not contaminate them with some truth. That's another thing that they particularly are very keen that we do not do, that we do not have any communication with those people. The next category are the hangers-on, the people that turn up to our events and camps simply because they want to rumble, they want to be fed, they want to make sure that their own income is secure for their drink or drug habits, so they latch onto us for those reasons. And also, there are the very sad individuals who are maybe homeless and are desperate for company, and they're not likely to be quite so disruptive, but because of their reputation and their appearance, will give us a bad name. And then finally, there's the actors. And you'll find these associated with the media. You'll get a media van turn up with all the equipment and cameras and God knows what. But out of the same vehicle, we'll get someone dressed as a clown or in other some ridiculous outfit who will start causing as much attention-grabbing behaviour as they possibly can. And they are then filmed or photographed, and that goes into the newspapers, creating an image that we are not serious, that we are a bunch of idiots. to create a disreputation, if that's not really a real word, but that's what they do. So that's the five categories. There's the police, the industry themselves, the people that are simply freeloading, those that are suffering in society, such as the homeless, and finally the media and their part-time stooges who cause trouble.
What about alternative media, though? Because a lot of people look to that for the only possible truth, you know, since a lot of the time the mainstream press is simply not reporting, as you said, on some of the most important dangers of things like fracking.
Well, alternative media comes in two pretty broad categories. But you have the rather slick presentation of alternative media and the amateur alternative media. Now, if you look at this is quite easy to identify. The ones that are a bit too slick with their own studio and their own special equipment and good quality cameras, those are controlled opposition. The ones that are amateurs just taking film from their camera or doing a bit of live streaming without very much in the way of polish, those are the ones you can trust. Those are the ones that are the genuine campaigners trying to get the word out. And that's how I differentiate between the two. I can tell what is controlled opposition. I've had far too many years doing this. A controlled opposition operative will always present a very polished package. They've got pride in their product. And that actually gives them away.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'd like to introduce John Hagedorn, who's host of the popular podcast. Well, it's called 1001 Heroes, Legends and Histories and Mysteries. Can you just take us through your podcast? I mean, is it just one subject you look at or lots of different subjects, John?
I'd love to. Just based on the name alone, it's 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories and Mysteries, which gives me a lot of latitude to chase down different subjects of history, which is something I enjoy doing very much. It's a weekly show. It comes out anywhere people listen to podcasts every Sunday night between 8 and 9. The reason I say between 8 and 9 is we release it at 8, but sometimes iTunes and some of the others might take a half an hour, an hour to catch up. But we cover lots of different subjects, a lot having to do with history, some not having to do with history. For instance, we'll cover UFOs. We've got one episode titled Astronauts and Aliens. And we've got a lot of interview footage of astronauts who have gone up and seen things. And by all means, those guys believe there's something up there. The code of their work, though, pretty much prohibits them from talking about it. But when you listen to the ones who have retired and who do talk about it, you won't have any doubt anymore as to whether or not we're not alone, so to speak.
Well, the Americans not alone in space, but surely, the military has put up over the decades, really since the 1950s, a lot of smoke screens with regards to aliens, when actually what's going on is a lot of high-level military testing in the atmosphere, in the upper atmosphere, even in space, by the superpowers. And so, of course, the idea of aliens is a convenient smokescreen.
Oh, I agree with you. There's, in fact, right, just within the past couple of days, there was a video released taken from an American F-A-18 jet. I believe it was in 2004. I believe it was over San Diego. And it was not just one jet. It was a couple of these pilots talking, and they had caught these fast-moving craft on their radar. And the video is out there viral right now. Usually when you see video, it's grainy and it's taken by civilian. In this case, this was taken by an Air Force pilot, and you've got the audio and the video of very fast-moving objects that these guys had spotted. And the reason this came out, one of the newspapers finally covered a secret program that the U.S. government had in place until 2012. And, the program was set up for the purpose of identifying some of the objects that are encountered by the military. The program was a $23 million a year budget, but it was disbanded in 2012. So somebody caught it, and they're bringing that back out.
Now that's just one type of podcast that you do. I mean, how do you feel about the medium of the podcast? I mean, they are portable, but surely, John, it would be much better if you were out there on mainstream FM radio, digital radio, even television.
Well, you tell me. You're a radio announcer, quite popular in the UK. I don't know if in the venue that I enjoy and the way I speak, because I have to edit a lot of my presentations. I just can't speak normally into a mic for an hour and not have it come out with a lot of spaces in it. So I think maybe I'm better suited for podcasting, because then I get a chance to I have to research, I have to write, I have to do the audio, then I have to edit the audio. But when I'm finished, we've got a pretty good presentation out there.
But, I mean, that would work just as well on a pre-recorded program for radio and TV. I just wonder if you think that the climate out there in mainstream corporate network TV and radio is ready for some of the stories that you've come up with.
Absolutely. The stories are fascinating to anybody who is the student of life and anybody who's a student of history.
Well, John, we recently spoke about this battle towards the very end of the Second World War, Operation Market Garden, and you did a whole program, a bit of an interview with me and a load of people who were actually involved in this battle as well, sewn in amongst the interview. Now, what was it that initially attracted you to have a look at Operation Market Garden? This is the Bridge Too Far film, which was made very famous back in the 1980s, and it was actually a blockbuster film starring Robert Redford and a whole load of other stars, directed by Richard Attenborough. But what was it that attracted you to this particular operation in the World War II?
That's a great question, Tony. Occasionally, I will do military history stories. We did one on Midway that's been in our top 10 out of the 150 that we've done. We did one on Guadalcanal. And we did one recently on a British commando raid on Saint-Nazaire, which is an incredible story. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that one.
Well, I think the thing is, for the Brits, I think a lot of British listeners aren't necessarily familiar with these big US operations. So can you just tell us in a nutshell what was interesting about Midway and what was interesting about Guadalcanal?
Well, with Midway, a book had just come out called Never Call Me a Hero. And it was about one of the key pilots that actually dive-bombed the Japanese carriers in Midway. They were able to sink five and literally turn the tide of the war within a period of about 40 minutes. And this man named Dusty Kleiss, this was the story of his life and in those critical minutes during World War II. Very, very well done by a husband-wife team. And I looked them up. They happened to be living in the same city that I am, in Norfolk, Virginia. I couldn't resist. I gave them a call. They said, yeah, let's do an interview. So we did an interview about their book, Never Call Me a Hero, about Dusty Kleiss. And at the same time, I had been working on this story of Midway. It's an incredible drama and a combination of tremendous intelligence, tremendous courage, tremendous training, and how the entire world, the war in the Pacific, was turned around in 40 minutes.
Okay, could you just tell us how it fitted into the Pacific War? Because obviously that was something which, I think it's fair to say the Brits aren't that familiar with, because it was going on the opposite side of the world between the Japanese and the U.S.
Yeah, after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese had taken out about 40 to 50% of our fleet and rendered us almost powerless. The one break we had in Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, was that we did not have any carriers present in in Pearl. So what we lost was a lot of battleships and destroyers and subs and a good portion of the Pacific Fleet.
Some people have said that there was some foreknowledge of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and that's how those carriers went chugging out a few days beforehand, that the U.S. actually needed some kind of shocking attack on themselves by the Japanese in order to persuade the Congress and the House of Representatives to actually, and the, I suppose the President, I think, was probably already decided, but to get the Democratic part of the government to go along with having a war with Japan, which, you know, nobody really wanted.
Yeah, I've heard that theory as well, and I my feeling on that is I feel there may be some grains of truth in that, but I don't think it was an out-and-out conspiracy to let us get clobbered at Pearl Harbor. And to ignore intelligence. We definitely should have been more on guard at that time. From what I've read, it was basically luck and preset timing that those carriers were not in port at that time. It could well be otherwise, because it all makes sense from the point of an armchair historian. But just based on the research I've done, I'd say it was more luck.
Okay, so how does Midway fit in? Obviously, that was a while later in the Pacific War.
Midway came in 1943, and at that point, it had been a cat-and-mouse game between the American carrier forces and the Japanese carrier forces. But the U.S. was able to intercept intelligence from the Japanese, because it wasn't that easy to locate carrier groups. Our intelligence guys in Hilo were able to finally figure out what the Japanese code was that they were using between home base and their carrier groups. They did it by setting up a sort of an experiment using Midway Island. We were sending out our coded messages to each other that were false, saying that our water supply on Midway was running very, very low, that the garrison was in trouble. And we didn't know the code for Midway that the Japanese used, or how they were putting their code together. And when they started buzzing based on that message, we were able to figure out what their code was. And that enabled us to pretty much get the basic locations of the movements of their largest carrier force, which we did. And we planned an ambush, and we caught them literally with their pants down in the middle of the Pacific, and we were able to sink in one day five carriers, a cruiser, and some other ships. I don't have the exact information on me, but it was a turkey shoot.
It sounds to me like a real kind of an aircraft carrier battle, where you've got aircraft flying out from the carriers trying to sink the other side's carriers. Is that what was happening?
Yeah, that's what was happening. These were the first real carrier battles that were happening with the Navy, and you're right. It was three types of airplanes on each carrier. You had your low-level torpedo planes, you had your high-level dive bombers, and you had fighters, which also doubled as scout planes. So three types of planes on both of those carriers, and that entire war in the Pacific, on the sea, was basically being carried out between planes of one carrier group and planes of another carrier group. And the object to see was who could hit who and who could do the most damage.
What about Guadalcanal then?
Guadalcanal was a marine landing action, which cost us a huge number of men. It was the name of our episode is Guadalcanal, Hell in the Pacific. It literally was hell. It was really the beginning of the island hopping campaign that was to bring us closer and closer and closer to Saipan and Japanese homeland. And at Guadalcanal, we found out that we were up against a lot more than just embedded Japanese, that we were up against malaria, extreme heat, dehydration, sickness, a lot of factors that took out a lot of our fighting men. And it was really only due to the incredible courage of the men who fought there that we were able to defeat the Japanese, and that really began the backward treading on their part as they began to slowly give up island by island, and we conquered island by island, getting us closer to Saipan and the Japanese mainland. It was just an incredibly tough campaign. It was tough fought. The men, I'll give you an example, the men who went on that island, weighing in at 170 pounds by the time they got off there 3 months later, were weighing, for the most part, under 120.
Let's get on to look at Market Garden. What made you decide to do a show on Market Garden?
I wanted to take an operation that I knew that our U.S. Airborne 82nd and 101st had participating in, and I wanted an operation in World War II that was a major operation, but one that doesn't get talked about a lot. And Operation Market Garden, from all my research, really filled the bill on that.
Well, that's amazing. I'm amazed to hear that you say that it didn't get talked about much, because this is one of the most talked about, certainly in this part of the world, and certainly in Holland, one of the most talked about battles in the whole of the Second World War. Because, number one, because it was a very audacious attack, the idea of dropping paratroopers many miles behind enemy lines and trying to establish a kind of corridor of tanks into very, very close to the Ruhr and over the Rhine. It was an audacious attack, and also because of the way that it failed and all of the questions that there have been since about the intelligence involvement in whether the operation should have taken place in the first place, and also why so many Brits at of the 1st Airborne Division in Arnhem managed to get captured or killed. I mean, it was absolute slaughter, but there were lots and lots of questions about it, and that seems to be why I actually think it's particularly the Dutch that keep talking about it, because of course it was about the liberation of Holland.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think all the points you just made are excellent points, and I certainly don't claim to be on the leading edge of what is being discussed over here on this side of the water.
And I wonder also if we're in a situation here where there's a certain amount of embarrassment over it, because actually what happened was there's a two US divisions, as you say, the 82nd and the 101st, seemed to perform very well, and yet the 1st Airborne Division, the British, didn't manage to keep their objective, even though they'd been given the most difficult task. So take us through, if you can, you know, the 16,000 casualties in Market Garden, and you know why you think that the sacrifices there were overlooked.
I would say that Operation Market Garden, because it wasn't a successful operation, which if you look at most of the offensive operations of World War II, although they were very, very costly, they were almost all successful in achieving what they set out to achieve. Maybe someone listening can find an exception to that. But I would say Market Garden was the one that didn't achieve the desired results. I think it's possibly that it's not talked about a lot, I think, on this side of the water, because we tend not to talk about failures. We tend to talk about successes.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. Yeah, I mean, I think, for example, if you go to look at the hieroglyphics still there in Egypt about the wars back, you know, sort of 1,000 years BC, you'll find that where there's a victory over the Egyptians, it doesn't appear. You know, basically there is no history written about failures and disasters. It's only the sort of heroics that get written into history in those times. And in fact, there's an attempt, I think, to do that today still. We have Winston Churchill and his famous phrase, history will be kind to me, I know, because I will write it. So there's definitely this idea of history is written by the winners. And of course, the Allies were not the winners at Market Garden.
The reason I wanted to do the story was because I felt that the incredible courage shown by men on all sides, the U.S. forces, the Poles, the Brits, the Canadians, the incredible courage that these men displayed when the whole fault was really lying in their command, I thought was incredible. And I thought it was a story that needed to be retold. Certainly long in the line of how many people have told the story. I thought the movie was great, but I wanted to tell it in a history podcast so that when people do look it up. And there's a lot more people coming to podcast these days that when they search Operation Market Garden, they can find this episode and really understand the heroism that took place in that operation.
Well, what's your attitude to the Germans, John? Because, you know, it's a lot of water under the bridge now. And looking at that whole situation with an entire corps of tanks heading their way, with a corps of airborne, that's three divisions, dropping all around them, it seems that they did actually quite a good job themselves in defending the Rhine.
I don't think, there's not too many people who would call the German forces sloppy or ill-equipped or uncourageous. I think the Germans always fought courageously. They just seem to be more of a warlike people, and they're good at it. I think, though, with the Germans, a lot of it was mind control. From the time you're a German youth, you're pretty much brought up into the army with the idea that what your commander says, if he says that you're going to stay in one spot until you die, you're going to stay in one spot until you die. There's no question in that. And the Germans, at the point, at least of Operation Market Garden, felt like they were defending their homeland, and they were getting more and more desperate, and they were putting up more and more of a fight. I think where the problem was underestimating how much of a fight they could put up. The story had been put out with Operation Market Garden that the Germans were on the run and that they were disorganized. Well, I think they proved everybody wrong. Some of that might have had to do with intelligence that they had gained based on where and how the Allies were going to strike. But I think a lot of it was just the way the German command was set up. And it was a lot more flexible, I think, than people give them credit for.
Well, someone I interviewed a couple of years ago, his uncle was an officer, British officer at Nuremberg, and was escorting Nazi officers around who were on trial at Nuremberg. And one of them said to him something along the lines of, well, you've beat us this time, but next time it will be us that wins and you won't even know until it's all over. So there, I think there was definitely a consciousness around at the end of the Second World War that this was not going to be the end of the game, and that actually that's one of the reasons why the Wehrmacht and the SS were fighting so determinedly, even though it looked as if defeat was staring them in the face, was that they, many of them, certainly the senior people, were aware that there was going to be a recrudescence of the Nazi forces after the war in a different form of some kind, and that they needed this extra time in order to squirrel away their looted billions of dollars worth, or whatever marks, obviously it would have been more, but a fantastic amount of wealth that they'd looted from the whole of Europe, all around the world, particularly obviously in very nearby Switzerland, who are very discreet about the wealth that they keep there, and places like Argentina. But look, let's get on to the battle itself. Where do you think that the Market Garden plan went wrong, John?
First of all, from the original planning, we can look back and say, well, Montgomery was audacious. He was looking for a quick strike, but he did not plan that well based on the actual resistance that was there on the part of the Germans. He had good intelligence, but he basically ignored intelligence because he wanted so much for his idea to take flower and to be acted upon. And I think he was willing to overlook good intelligence, like the kind of intelligence that Urquhart was trying to give him. And that's why Urquhart was dismissed. I think he did not appoint the wrong people for leadership positions. Generally, General Boy Browning is a great example of that. I think he might have been prepared to handle the accounting for the Queen as he did after the war, but I don't think he was prepared to conduct war.
Where Browning arrived? Because, you know, you would normally expect the general in charge of the corps to be, I mean, not necessarily right at the spearhead of the battle, but certainly around where the main objective was, in order to be on scene to give his orders, down the food chain. But he didn't, did he? He didn't go to Arnhem. He went to Nijmegen, and actually that was where the battle was lost, and it was partly his influence. Do you want to just talk about Browning's role?
He determined that the drop zone would be just outside of Nijmegen, and he had a lot of planes that were really scheduled to deliver Polish paratroopers used instead to deliver his base setup for his base HQ. Planes and planes and planes of office equipment, intelligence equipment, whatever he needed in order to defend the base. And then he was going to take a huge portion of Gavin's men to make sure that once that was set up, that that was safe. You could argue that Gavin's men were needed to protect the drop zone, and that's true. They were. But German resistance was tough in that first day, but after that, it pretty much concentrated right around the foot of the Nijmegen Bridge. And there were a number of chances there, I believe, that could have been decisive in terms of committing enough troops to taking out that German garrison at the foot of that bridge, which was apparently Waffen-SS, and it was apparently in excess of 500 fighting men. So it was not an easy task, but they never ordered a strafing of that garrison at the southern end of that bridge. And they would send in unit after unit, but those units were being repulsed by the Germans. So whatever we had to throw on, it wasn't enough. And there were a couple of days lost there in that process. That was all done under Browning's leadership. And you can argue that, well, Gavin was in charge of that. But I really believe, based on the research I've done, that it looks like Browning was pulling the 82nd's strings with regard to what General Gavin could do and couldn't do. And Gavin, you're right, you want to compare the two. Gavin parachuted in with his men, whereas I'm not sure how Browning got to where he was. But in terms of his command capabilities, I can't find anything in my research that indicates that Browning was on the ball. On the night of the 20th, this was more than 2 days into the initial drop, Browning orders Gavin to come up with a plan for a night attack on that German garrison that was guarding the south end of the Nijmegen Bridge, preventing our tanks from coming across. And just before they're ready to pull off the attack, for reasons unwritten anywhere, Browning calls it off. And that was those were critical hours 11 miles north of there for the Brits trying to hang on in Arnhem. So I would just say that Browning wasn't prepared to lead. I'm not going to go so far as to say it was any nefarious reasons. I think it was just, and a lot of people look toward Browning's lack of leadership and what looks like a lack of good decision-making on the part of, certainly on the part of Carrington, on the part of Horrocks, on the part of Field Marshal Montgomery, that military rank isn't determined. It wasn't determined at that time, at least in the British military, as much by success on the battlefield as it was by social rank. And I think military appointments up until that time, I don't know how they are now, but in Britain, were made with the idea, well, this is going to move you up socially. And this person is slated for this position based on who he knows and who his family knows and what kind of registry he has. And I think that at that time, at least in World War II and before that, that's been a deterrent to British overall military fighting ability or command ability.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And subscribe if you like and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests you just heard there, John Hagedorn from 1001heroespodcast.com, talking about the Battle of Arnhem in World War II, too far from the bridge. Also, before that, Frances Leader, who runs Frank News. She's based in Dorset and she's the editor of that Facebook site and website. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good Christmas and New Year. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
take some beating, pop pickers.